This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live.
Well, good morning, everybody. It's March the 8th, and I'm very excited because today I'm going to be joined by one of my all-time favourite educators and authors, Emma Turner. And I've just seen Emma has arrived here in the studio, so let's manifest, listeners, that hopefully Emma will be joining us shortly. We're going to be talking all about Emma's brand new book, but she is an author of several books. I'm sure we'll dive into that today. There's so much I want to tell you about Emma, but the good news is Emma is here to tell you all about herself and her book. So without further ado, good morning, Emma.
Good morning. Are you well?
I am so well because you are here on Teachers Talk Radio.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I'm so excited. How's your week been, Emma? Has it been a good week for you?
It's been a little bit one of those crazy weeks where when you open your diary, you just have a look at it and want to be slightly sick. But apart from that, yes, we're now at the end of it. It's all good. And it's obviously International Women's Day today. So very pleased to be on here talking to you today.
Yes. Happy International Women's Day to you, Emma, and to all our listeners. And what a great thing to talk about on International Women's Day than you, an empowering, inspirational woman and one of your books. So, wow, without further ado, can we just jump in?
Mm-hmm.
So I know later on we'll talk about lots of the other amazing things you've done, but we're here today to talk about your brand new book, Initium. And I just wanted to start with the title for my listeners, but also for me. What exactly does the title of this book mean?
There's an amusing story behind this, because I called it Initium because my other two curriculum books had got sort of Latin-based title, so I called it Initium, and then I sent a copy to Bradley Bush from Inner Drive to have a look at, and he said, how do you say it? And I said, well, it's Initium. And he said, well, it can't be, because there's no sh in Latin. It's meant to be Initium. So I was like, brilliant, I've written a book where I can't even pronounce the title. So oh, it's meant to be Initium, which Bradley schooled me in. And it actually means, or is roughly translated as beginning or the start. So the beginning of kind of cognitive science with younger children. That was the thinking behind the title. But I think I'm probably the only person in the world who's ever written a book where they can't pronounce their own title.
It's always good to be in our learn and stretch zone, Emma. So that's not, yes, a bad thing. And actually, when I first saw your book coming out, the title really, I actually love that air of mystery around it. I was like, what does this mean? I was trying to dust off my GCSE Latin from secondary school. So it roughly means beginning.
Yeah, beginning.
Fantastic. So I know you gave us a little sneak peek there, something around the beginning of cognitive science. Can you maybe just tell us a little bit more then, for anyone who's interested in buying Initium, what is a kind of general summary of this book, please?
Well, I've worked a lot in primary sort of teaching and learning, sort of 26 years of primary teaching, but also a lot of work within the understanding how we learn. And a lot of the information about cognitive science and about research-informed practice had come from studies that were done with either undergraduates or older students. So there wasn't necessarily that huge body of knowledge around what does the research say about younger students in school. And from the school visits that I do, my school improvement work, from a lot of the sort of support work that I do with schools, there was quite a lot of application of cognitive science practices where the theory was correct, but the enactment wasn't matching the developmental stage of a younger student, a younger pupil. Because a lot of the guidance around what cognitive science looks like in practice was coming from a secondary standpoint. So it wasn't that cognitive science was wrong for primary children, it needed to go through the primary lens and also sit alongside aspects of child development and early childhood. So Initium originally was to pull together all of the kind of research areas that impact on learning and development with younger children, which included cognitive science. So thinking about children's journeys in education right from the beginning, from early years and through primary, and thinking, what do we need to know from the science of learning, but also the science of child development, to bring those together in how we can implement teaching and learning and ensure that learning happens with our youngest children. So that's kind of why I wrote it and where it sits in terms of understanding the sort of target audience, I guess.
Wow. I mean, if we had to think if we ever needed a book to really understand these initial building blocks of education, I think this is it. This
you.
Is it. And let's pick up there. You've mentioned this term now a few times, cognitive science, and you've kind mm-hmm. of explained briefly. Am I right in thinking then cognitive science is this scientific study of our intelligence, of our kind of behaviors, how we learn? Is that kind of a general understanding of cognitive science? Have you got
okay,
a definition?
So cognitive science, if you take the George Miller model, so George Miller sort of has this little diagram if you Google it, and cognitive science is kind of a broad church, really. So it includes philosophy, psychology, linguistics, computer science, neuroscience, anthropology. So cognitive science includes a lot of, it's a broad selection of disciplines which sit under this umbrella term. So when we're talking about cognitive science, we can be talking about everything from the psychology of learning to the neuroscience of learning to how humans have developed over time through anthropology. So it's a huge area, but very often it only gets used to describe a few things. But actually, in the George Miller model, it's actually quite a broad church.
Wow. So thank you for explaining that. Okay, so it covers a lot of things. Did mm-hmm. that make yep. it harder to try and put it all into the book? I mean, how long is the book? I feel like this is a lot to talk about.
Well, the book's a fairly slim volume because I took the stance of the fact that a lot of people already know quite a bit about cognitive science in terms of retrieval, in terms of novices and experts, in terms of the importance of connection and the model of memory. But what I really wanted to do is pass those through what needs to happen with our younger learners and what it's like to teach and learn within a primary setting. So I kind of, rather than trying to cover every single aspect of cognitive science, what I did was think, okay, what's it like to teach young children, and what's it like to teach in the primary classroom, and what do primary teachers potentially need to know or would really help them to sharpen their practice by using what we know about how we learn to implement that in their practice. So I kind of came from the what's a primary child like and what's it like to teach in primary and what would help, rather than try to say, right, here's this enormous canon of knowledge about what we know about how we learn. Let's cover everything. It was more about what's it like and what can we do day to day in school.
That's so interesting. And I must say, as soon as I saw your book, the thing that I loved already before I even opened it, the fact that it is just research informed, because I think so often in education mm-hmm. we're given ideas that haven't truly been explored, that aren't fully supported by research. And I think, you know, it's one thing I really drive with my trainee teachers. That's why I've been telling them all about your book, because we mm-hmm. need to know the research behind it. Yes, anecdotal experiences are useful, but I mean, that's what I really love about your book. So you've touched on there what prompted you to write from a primary angle. Mm-hmm. Was that always a straightforward decision? You always knew you wanted to look at those younger learners?
Yes. I've been in primary now for forever. I've got to stop telling people I'm 35 because it just doesn't wash anymore. I've been doing it for 26 years. But I absolutely can say that primary education and working with younger children has been one of the most ongoing, biggest joys of my life. And I absolutely love working with our youngest learners. So it was a complete given that I was always going to write about primary practice. Plus, although I trained as a Key Stage 2-3 teacher, I've spent the bulk of my career, well, all of my career in primary. So I can't really write from a secondary angle because I haven't got that day-to-day lived experience of working in the secondary phase. I can talk about theory all day long, but I can't talk with confidence about what it might look like in practice. And I think that's where the power lies in terms of really moving people's practice forward, is being able to combine both the theory with that realistic overview of what it's like to teach in that phase, and being able to pepper the research with evidence of what this might look like and kind of touch points of, you know, this is what it feels like to be in a literacy lesson in year two, this is what it feels like to be in an art lesson in year four. So it was always an easy decision to write from primary because that's what I know, that's what I love, and I think that's potentially where there was a bit of a gap in terms of thinking, well, what does the research mean for younger children?
Definitely. And do you know what, Emma, when I first spoke to a publisher, they told me, write about what you know. And when I read your book, I just felt like I was in safe expert hands. Like, you can see that's where your passion is. And I think, you know, that's the main thing that comes through the book for me, is just I can hear your passion, I can hear your expertise. And it just kind of gave me trust in what you were saying as well. So also thank you to you for, you know, writing about what you know.
Thank you.
So how today is going to work, Emma? We've got a whole kind of hour together just to focus on you and your fantastic book. I've got a whole list of questions. We've got a lot of people listening live as well. Hello, everyone listening live. If you do have any questions for Emma about her amazing new book, Emma, remind me how to say it.
Well, do you know what? Every time I say it differently. So let's just go with our own interpretation of it, shall we?
Okay, we're gonna say Initium. Feel free to heckle me in the chat. And the word taken from Latin, meaning the beginning. But do you know what? We are not living in the Latin age, so we're using our interpretation. But if you do have any questions about Emma's book and you want to know more, do feel free to type if you're listening live, and I can put some of the questions forward to Emma at the end of the show. Emma, we'll have our news to play at around 11:30 as well, with advert from our amazing publisher John Catt, who published your fantastic book. So you will get a little breather at around the halfway mark.
Okay.
So the next question I wanted to ask you then, we know that this book gives us great insight into how we can support learners with cognitive science and cognitive development. Are there any specific considerations for research-informed practice within this primary phase?
You say we've only got an hour.
Okay, can we have you back for part two in the future?
We'll talk about this for about 4 days. Yes, there are huge ones. And I interviewed Cole Hendrick yesterday with Tom Sherrington for another podcast. And he was talking about how important it is for anybody who's working with research to understand the phase and to understand all the research that links into that particular phase. So with primary in mind, there is this kind of duality of development that we need to be aware of, that actually we need to be aware of not only the cognitive science aspects, but also the child development aspects. And if we are only looking at just what we know about cognitive science, we are potentially missing a massive trick, because it's a huge developmental trajectory for children in primary. And if you come to any of my training, I always use the phrase that we move children from the edge of toddlerhood to the cusp of adolescence in our phase, and that is a huge developmental trajectory.
Wow.
So we have to balance. I mean when I think about, I've got a slide that I use in some of my training with a picture of my eldest daughter on her first day in foundation and her last day in year six, and you can just see so starkly that developmental window writ large just in two photographs. And I think that if we solely focus on the cognitive, we forget that actually we need to be mindful of a really broad range of research for dealing with and working with children who are so tiny. Some of them a couple of days before they start with us were three. You know, they really are so teeny tiny, and then they leave us, and I'm not a very tall person. Most of them leave bigger than me as they go off to high school. And we have to balance the cognitive science alongside what we know about child development. So all the way through the book, it talks about respecting the unique phase of childhood and respecting the unique phases that children go through. One of the key ones is around attentional development. So we know from the model of memory, everybody's seen the model of memory, and everybody's seen that bit where attention is the gatekeeper of learning. But attention in primary is a really distinct maturational timeline. So children go through a specific neurological development in terms of how they can sustain and control their attention. And it always makes me laugh that there was a study done which said that children under the age of 8 are more distractible. It's like, well, really? Somebody had to do a study for that. Just wander down any key stage one corridor. There you go.
Yeah, I don't think anyone was shocked with the findings of that study.
No. But also that the way children control and sustain their attention isn't fully developed until about the age of 12, with a critical maturation point at about 6 and another one at 8. So as much as we would potentially like to sit them on, or not necessarily like to, but as much as you may try to sit children down for extended periods of time to listen with sustained voluntary concentration, it's really hard for them. And for some children, they haven't reached that maturation point yet. That's not to say children can't attend to things. Of course they can. They, and for extended periods, but in a different way from older children. So understanding that, as well as kind of physical observable developments for children, like they get taller, they get bigger, they get more coordinated. There is actually a lot going on inside their heads that is different at different stages. And that has implications for the way we structure our lessons, the way we structure our instructional approaches, the way that we devise tasks for them, the way that we expect them to use language. So attention is a huge one. And the other one is about play and playfulness. Mm-hmm. And that very often play is the first thing to become eroded in the classroom. In primary, and actually play has so many neurological, physiological, social developments that children won't get to practice and access and explore at a later date. So actually sometimes we're potentially robbing Peter to pay Paul if we remove the playfulness and play aspect of primary provision and move too quickly towards more extended periods of formal instruction for our very youngest children. So there's lots and lots of aspects of what we do that need to go through, yes, the cognitive science lens in terms of this, what is what's going on in terms of making new memories, mm-hmm. but also in terms of that broader development of the child in that unique phase of childhood. So balancing those two has huge implications for primary teachers, primary practitioners, and it's kind of going back to both of them and saying, okay, well, how do we manage this duality? How do we manage it in terms of our task design, our classroom instructional approaches, our provision for the children, and even the structure of the day? What do we expect, and how do we know that this is the right thing to expect at this age group? Because they are not little secondary pupils. They are not big kids in smaller bodies. They are a distinct developmental stage, and we need to be mindful of that in order to make sure that what we want them to understand actually lands.
Exactly. Oh my goodness, such good words there. Like, I'm going to make sure all my students listen back to this. And that's what I loved about your new book, Initium, because you really have captured that need for balance between, as you say, an understanding of childhood as well as that understanding of learning. And I think too often we're so focused on the learning outcomes and what the work looks like at age appropriate level, we're forgetting that actually they're people behind, you know, the pencil. And that's what I think you really do a good service in your book. Like, I would highly recommend to any trainee teachers, current teachers, just to have that better understanding and just put it back on your radar, I think, that these are tiny people who are still maturing. And I think that, you know, that's such a valid message, isn't it?
And it's interesting because there was quite a debate over the weekend on social media about group work and about whether children learn in group work. And it'd be so easy to listen to the discussions around group work and as a primary practitioner think, oh gosh, group work is bad, I must not do group work, you know, this doesn't work in terms of memory and instruction. But what we need to be mindful of in primary is that we serve potentially a different purpose sometimes, or a complementary purpose, in that if we are trying to teach children about a set of knowledge, a set of facts, then group work might not be the most instructionally sound way to do that. However, if we don't ever do any group work in primary school, then we never give children a chance to learn how to interact with each other, to take turns, to not get cross when somebody takes the equipment before you, to not know how to interact and speak in extended sentences. So group work in primary provides a very different area to explore, a very different mechanism, very different outcome to what you might do in secondary. So we kind of have to listen to the debates around what's good versus bad, or effective versus ineffective, and actually think, okay, what do we want for our younger pupils? Because we might do a piece of an aspect of group work, but that was not designed to secure the knowledge. That was designed for a very different purpose, to do things like turn taking, sharing, knowing how to interact and function as a group. Because if we send children up to high school, not able to function as a group, to turn take, to share, to wait, to be patient, then we're doing them a disservice. So we've got to be really mindful of the messaging around some of the research and actually what that means for younger students as well, so that we don't end up in a polarized conversation that doesn't actually relate to the phase that we're working in.
Definitely. And actually, I think you've done that really well in the book, where you've actually really kind of shown the reasoning behind certain kind of strategies we can use in the classroom. And it actually makes sense, like you say, in the bigger picture, how well we're actually preparing them for those next stages, those next rites of passage. And honestly, if it's any consolation, my adult learners at university still struggle with group work. So we definitely need to keep doing things like that, in my opinion, as well. Emma, I just want to pick up something you spoke about there when you're answering that question. And you spoke about, you feel play is eroded, or the place of play is eroded as children go higher up the primary school. Why do you think that is?
I think it's the pressure of multiple reasons. It's pressure of an overly jam-packed curriculum. So people are just trying to race through curriculum content to tick it off, basically. So firstly, it's curriculum design a lot of the time. Another one, again, is occasionally there can be a misunderstanding of how important play and playfulness is for younger children. And there can be a conflation of, well, if children are writing loads of stuff in books, that's the best way to learn something, rather than actually saying, you know, children need time to play, pure play as part of their development, but also a playful approach means that they are actually more likely to sort of engage with the subject. It reflects their age and stage. It reflects the fact that they are hardwired to play. So I think, I mean, I've visited schools where I went into one school and I went into a classroom and all the tiny furniture was in rows, all cable tied together, and with no storage. And it turned out that was the foundation stage class.
What?
Wow. And
cable tied together?
Yeah,
why?
The tables in rows, I don't know. And some of the
so there was no option for any flexibility ever.
No.
So what message that was giving the pupils, you know, that things are rigid? And
thankfully that's an extreme that I don't see on my travels, but it was the fact that the school was trying to replicate quite a formal level of a formal approach to instruction across the school, so that there was consistency. But what had got lost along the way was actually that different children at different age groups need a different approach to the school day. So I think that sometimes one of the reasons play gets eroded is because in the search for consistency, saying that this is a whole school approach to teaching and learning, you know, all of our lessons are going to look like this, or they're going to have all of these elements. And what gets lost then is actually, well, is this right for this particular age group or this particular stage? And so we really need to kind of think really carefully about how we craft the classroom and how we craft the lesson, so that we don't end up eroding what the children actually need. And in terms of the rhythm of the day, the rhythm of a Key Stage 1 child's day should feel very different to the rhythm of a Year 6's day. But very often, because we apply whole school approaches, but our developmental bandwidth is so rapid and so broad, it ends up being that the thing that the children really need gets eroded too early in the race towards kind of consistency and formal instruction.
And that's just heartbreaking, isn't it? Because even as adults, we love to play. Like, Emma, just tell you one cute thing. A few months ago, I got a Tough tray just at home. And I've got a 4-year-old, a 9-year-old and a 12-year-old. And we put shaving foam. The last one to be playing the longest was my 12-year-old. The other two had got bored and wandered off. And my 12-year-old, so year 8 in secondary school, all he wanted was to play about with some shaving foam. And I can guarantee, I bet, his secondary school does not have a single Tough tray. And it was like, you know, why is play being eroded? But I think that's what's so interesting in your book, is it doesn't forget that human element. So thank you also for that. What I'm going to do, I'm just going to ask you one last question and then we'll take the news break, if that's okay. When we come back, we will talk more about your book. But I have lots of favourite parts of your book, and I wanted to ask, particularly if anyone buys your book, like that's the main message of today, I love it, please buy it, and let us know what's your favourite. But Emma, do you have a favourite part of your new book, Initium? Apart from the title.
I was going to say, the part where everybody who I really respect in the cognitive science world wrote some lovely things about it at the front. That's my
yes, so wonderful.
You know, when the people you really look up to and you really admire and you think, oh my goodness me, you're fantastic people at Effort First. So I was, on a personal note, that's my favourite bit. But in terms of the
tell us, who have you got? Who are some of those brilliant people you've got in the front of your book?
We've got Sam Strickland, Dr. Carl Hendrick, Bradley Bush, Tom Sherrington, Patrice Bain, Richard Gerber, Effort First, Sir John Jones, Rachel Higginson. So all of lots of people.
Wow, that's like the red carpet of educators. For anyone listening who doesn't know, that's a good list.
and I must do a big kind of mention of Sarah Cottingham, who wrote the most beautiful, beautiful endorsement of the book, and then for some reason it was not in the front, so I'm going to say a personal thank you to Sarah Cottingham, because she's one of my absolute all-time edu heroes, and I completely geek out to everything that she writes. So Sarah didn't make it, and she wrote it, and I feel really bad because she wrote it whilst off on maternity leave and juggling a baby and work and everything, and she wrote this beautiful thing and didn't end up in there. So my secret favourite part of the book isn't even in the book, and that was Sarah Cottingham's endorsement of it.
Oh, shout out to Sarah, and thank you so much, Sarah, for writing that. And the main thing is, I guess, that you read it, Emma, and that you heard it, because I think that's really important.
Yeah, but in terms of the book itself, the content of the book itself, the chapter on connection, about how it all fits together, is, I think, my favourite part, where it talks about curriculum, it talks about practice, it talks about assessment, it talks about provision, talks about the whole thing, kind of pulls it all together. So that was the hardest chapter to write, but it's my favorite one in terms of in the actual content of the book.
Oh, wonderful. Tell us, what chapter number is that, Emma, just so I can make a note on my post-it note?
I should know this off by heart, since I actually haven't seen it. It is chapter 9, page 65.
All right, chapter 9. I'm putting that in the chat as well, just for any listeners who hopefully buy the book after today. have a look at chapter 9 about connection. And I just love even the theme of that chapter. Connection is the most important human thing that we need, I think. So to actually see what that needs to look like for young learners in the primary school in terms of their learning and development, I will have to go back and read chapter 9 after the show. Now it's had your personal endorsement. Oh, and David in the chat has just said he's just ordered your book, Emma, so that's very exciting.
Thank you.
David has just said he's ordered your book, one of our listeners. Thank you, David. You'll have to
thank
let us
you,
know.
David.
Think of it.
Thank you.
Have to give Emma a tag on socials when you drop her a review. That's wonderful. On that very positive note, let's take a break. Emma, don't go anywhere. Listeners, do not go anywhere. We'll be back in about 5 minutes' time with our amazing guest, educator and author, Emma Turner.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
School absence, a seemingly ever-present feature in our news at the moment, has raised its head again, this time in the form of fines for parents. The Guardian covers the detail that fines in England for unauthorised absence are set to rise by 33%. Education Secretary Gillian Keegan said she was bringing penalties under a national framework to help tackle inconsistencies. The Department for Education said fines must be considered if a child misses 5 days of school for unauthorised absence. Under the new rules, the initial penalty notices will increase from £60 to £80 per parent per child. Anyone who cannot pay within 21 days will have to pay £160 rather than the current £120. Schools will also share daily registers online with the Department for Education as part of the drive to improve. ASCL's Jeff Barton said the wider issues linked with poor attendance, such as anxiety, disengagement with education and wider social problems, needed addressing by working with families rather than fining them. Labour's Bridget Phillipson said the Conservative government was only just waking up to the damage of persistent absence, but that they should address the causes rather than the symptoms. The Daily Mail highlights the continuing difficulties faced by some schools in recruiting appropriate specialist staff for some subject areas. It reports on one school's desperation and the measures they have had to take by putting large numbers of pupils into masterclasses to support the teaching of science GCSE. Whilst the article describes the decision as a drastic measure, it points out that there is a nationwide crisis in teacher recruitment and retention, and government missing its teacher training targets yet again. Schools are increasingly using non-specialist teachers to cover classes, so the masterclass approach could be here to stay for a little while longer. School holidays featured in the news again, with the debate centering on the long summer break. It prompted much discussion on social media, and teachers, school staff and parents all joined in the debate. The Guardian, however, chose to focus on the benefits one school trust said it had noticed, this time in the area of staff attendance and well-being. The Unity Schools Partnership Trust found that staff absences fell by 50% after it extended the autumn half term by a week in both its primary and secondary schools. Pupil illness absence also fell by 25%. 58% of parents supported the change, which is now permanent, although parents of younger children expressed worries around childcare. In Wales, the BBC reports that the government has admitted to failing to follow the law when stopping free school meals during the holidays after the summer of 2023. Two families and a legal charity claimed ministers had not considered the rights of children. The government accepted it should have done more to assess the effect of the decision, but the Education Minister in Wales said the government could not afford to reintroduce the meals. The government will have to pay the legal costs of the claimants. Finally, the BBC also focuses on a scheme in one Lancashire high school which is encouraging students to embrace phone-free days. Pupils are able to hand in their mobile phones before lessons, and pupils themselves report greater focus and fewer distractions. But the school leaders also report reductions in incidents of bullying and online abuse. Esther Jai, mother of murdered schoolgirl Brianna Jai, has also had a video meeting this week with PM Rishi Sunak to discuss her campaign for greater online safety and an age limit for smartphones. She described the meeting as really productive. Schools were issued new guidance on mobile technology in February of this year. This has been your Teachers Talk Radio News with Jo Fox.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live.
Well, welcome back, everybody. Welcome back from the news. And very excited that I am joined here by educator and author Emma Turner. Welcome, Emma.
Hello.
If you were here for the first half of the show, or if you're listening back, we talked about Emma's brilliant book, Initium, and how it talks about supporting younger learners with cognitive science and why that is often overlooked. But Emma, before I ask you another question, I actually just want to appreciate how amazing you are, as it's International Women's Day. For those of you who don't know Emma Turner, and I'm sure most of you do, or you should, Emma has written this fantastic book, Initium. We'll talk more about that in a minute. But Emma has been serving our primary schools for 25 years. She's been a class teacher, an assistant head, a deputy head. She was also, and this is very cool to mention on International Women's Day, one half of one of the UK's first and youngest all-female co-headships. Okay, if we've got time at the end of the show, I'm going to put a pin in that. We're going to come back to that. Emma has been a consultant for National Strategies, Trust Research, CPD lead across 15 Leicestershire primary schools. And Emma currently works part-time as Deputy Director of Education.
No, I don't.
Emma also, in the past, worked for for West Midlands Trust. Emma's written other books, which we'll talk about later in the show, but we are here today to ask Emma Turner all about her book, Initium. And I just want to pick up one of the most lovely sentences from the book. I'm going to just read it out. The beginnings of all things are small, but the possibilities for our primary pupils are infinite. Isn't that beautiful? Emma, tell us about that sentence.
It was kind of relating to the neuroscience aspect of it, I guess, that we're all born with about 100 billion neurons at birth, and that those are so tiny, absolutely tiny, but the possibilities in the way that they go on to connect in our future learning and our future lives in so many unique and different ways means that everybody is born with this kind of endless possibility from these tiny, tiny things. And also in terms of the fact that when we receive and welcome children into school in primary, they are genuinely so little, but their paths aren't necessarily set yet. And we can help them to explore all those potential possibilities for their future lives. So that's where that line came from.
Beautiful. Thank you. I love when I talk to authors and I learn a little bit extra about I feel like I've got some inside knowledge now, and so have you, listeners. Thank you for sharing that. So we've got about 20 minutes left to talk about your brilliant new book. Before the news, Emma told us her favourite part of the book is chapter 9 about connection. I wanted to ask the next question to you, Emma. What was the biggest challenge with writing this book? Were there no challenges?
So some of the chapters were really, really easy to write. They just kind of flowed. I knew exactly what I was going to put. But some of them, you're dealing with content and aspects that are quite complex and have so many different potential iterations in the classroom that they were more challenging to kind of make readable and actionable and doable. So some of them took me a little bit longer to write. And I remember I had a most awful writer's block at one point for about a month and a half where nothing would come out because I was wrangling with the manipulative chapter because I knew exactly what I wanted to say, but I got about 7 solid days worth of stuff to say. So trying to pricey that one was tricky.
I think there's nothing worse than writer's block when you're a writer.
Yeah, you just have to walk away. Just walk away and believe it will come back. That's the only thing I'd say for anybody who's writing. Just don't stare at a blank screen. Walk away and come back to it.
Oh, good advice there for our listeners. I'll tell that to my students as well, Emma, when they're writing their assignments. I'll pass that on. Fantastic. So the good news is, though, that despite those challenges and despite the writer's block, you have written this amazing book published by John Catt. So let's have another question about the book then. What do you think you'd like colleagues from other phases, perhaps, so secondary, anyone maybe in even FE, further education, which is college here in the UK, or higher education even? So for me, training primary teachers, what's the one thing you'd really like them to know about primary practice?
It's not so much knowing about primary practice, it's the recognition of everybody in every phase, really, that we are not a constant for the child. The only constant in education is the child itself. They are the one that's going to pass through all of the different phases in education. So I think it's really important that as an individual phases, whichever one we're in, that we have an understanding of what's going to be happening next and also what's happened before. And that kind of respect that what works in one phase may be or may have elements of sort of transferable elements, but there won't ever be direct congruence. So it's that kind of understanding and respect for each other's phases and having an understanding of how you connect to their work and how they will connect to your work to enable that journey for the child to be uninterrupted and as smooth as possible, So I would say for anybody reading it, really, that it's to look, to read it through that lens of, well, how does this help me to understand what children's experiences might have been before, and also what children at different phases might need based on their age and stage.
I love that word you use there, Emma, about respect, just having respect for the other phases. I think that's so key. And I think this book really sets the perfect tone for understanding that primary phase. So thank you so much for sharing that. Oh my gosh, time's flying when I'm having fun talking to you, Emma. The next thing I wanted to ask then, I know we focused today on your book Initium, which talks about cognitive science and research-informed practice for younger children. But I know, and some of our listeners will know, you have written other books. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I've been adding them up, and I think you've written 4 previous books on education. Is that right?
I should know this, shouldn't I? So we read, the first one was Be More Toddler, which was about doing leadership differently and approaching leadership from a different standpoint, really. The next one was Let's Talk About Flex, which was all about changing the narrative around flexible working, because I've worked flexibly in education now for about 15 years. Then there was Simplicitas, then Simplicitas Altius. Then there was the co-authored book, The Extended Mind in Action, with Oliver Caviglioli and David Goodwin. And then there was Initium. So I don't know how many that is, but I really should know that, shouldn't I?
My goodness, I think this brings us up to number 6, including your co-authored book. So you have been busy.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, again, thank you for being such an inspiring role model on International Women's Day to show that women can be authors too. I love that. So I wonder, maybe just for anyone who's listening, who's kind of on the fence about buying this book, could you maybe share the list of chapters with us, just so we have a bit more of a feel for the book itself?
Okay, so we start off with the introduction that you mentioned about the beginning of all things being small, and the fact about that primary phase, and also about the kind of neurological development of the brain and neuroplasticity. And then we go into talking about this duality of development in the first, in the next chapter, about biologically primary and secondary knowledge, which is contested, that Geary model is contested, but actually it puts that again through the lens of the fact that children are still developing physically, emotionally, socially, very obviously, in those early years. So we talk about the difference between those sorts of developments and the development of biologically secondary knowledge. Then that moves into kind of looking at novice versus expert, and what I call the multi-novice status of the primary age child. The fact that, yes, there's a novice to expert continuum, but that is multiplied a thousandfold with very young children. Then we look at reducing transience, about how to reduce cognitive load and reduce transience in our methods of instruction in primary. And then how that moves into chapter 5 about forgetting and retrieval. And then the chapter that I wrangled with about manipulatives and how we can use those to improve learning. Then I look at what learning actually is, and that difference between what we perform and what we learn. That's always interesting on training whenever I do that one. There's a few kind of mic drop moments in that. And then we look at the about difficulty, about how it can feel a bit off. It doesn't feel comfortable to ask very little children very challenging questions, but actually talk about the importance of doing that in the learning process. Yeah. Then that chapter about connection, then a chunky little section about play and playfulness. Then finally about harnessing attention, because if we can't get children's attention, we can't get them to learn anything. And then the idea of overlearning, and that's linked to fluency and automaticity. And there's a little bit of a conclusion and biography. So that's, it covers a lot of areas of that are popular areas for discussion within cognitive science, but again, passes it through that developmental lens and primary practice lens as well.
Definitely, definitely. Thank you so much for giving us that clearer overview, just for anyone listening who hasn't heard of your book Initium before. And just for anyone who is feeling slightly bamboozled or overwhelmed by all those brilliant terms, I just have to say that what I think you've done really well, Emma, is you've made this book accessible. And actually, although you're dealing with some really big concepts and theories and theoretical frameworks, you have written it in such a way, like when I first got the book, the title scared me, I'm not going to lie. And I thought, am I going to understand this? Am I going to have time to read it? Because it sounds already complicated. But honestly, it was the opposite. Like, as a busy educator myself, I actually found myself just wanting to read it in the evenings, because you've written it in such an accessible and clear way. You've really broken down some of those big concepts. And like you say, the models. So for anyone listening who thinks this will be too highbrow for me, trust me, Emma, you have really done a good service to these big concepts. Like, for any educators, even trainee teachers, Emma will help you understand it through the way it's written.
Well, that's where Simplicity is one of my other books comes from, because the title means simplicity. And I do think that there's the potential to make lots of complex things overly complex, when actually, like you've mentioned, busy teachers and people who are potentially time poor but want to have that information, they need, colleagues need this explaining in a way that they can action in their practice without kind of getting raveled up. So one of the things that I always do in all of my writing is to try and make it as straightforward and as simple and as real as possible.
Well, I can confirm, as someone who absolutely loved reading your book, that you have achieved your goal. I think I read the whole thing in 2 evenings. It was done.
I wish I'd written it in 2 evenings, Buffy.
How long did it take you? How long was it?
I don't know. I do write fairly quickly. I had a bit of a block in the middle, but it probably took me about 3 or 4 months to write.
Wow.
But you evenings only. After the children had gone to bed, sit down, open the laptop, start writing.
I love this. Working mama and inspirational author. I absolutely, like, thank you on behalf of me and other women for showing you can have a career, you can publish books. Like, wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're getting towards the end. I've just kind of got 3 more questions to ask you. So the first one, what would you say to anyone considering buying this book?
I would buy it if you, like we've just said, wanted a really straightforward approach that talks actually about what it looks like in the classroom as well, that gives you some practical examples, that explains what it might look like in your English lesson or your art lesson, what it might kind of look and feel like when you're actually trying to implement this with younger children. So if you haven't quite found any of the cognitive science or research informed writing chiming with what you need in terms of your day-to-day primary practice, and this might be worth a little dip into. And also, I would say, if you're expecting super super duper highbrow academic writing, that's not what you're gonna get.
But in a good way.
In a very deliberate way, to kind of make it easy to read.
Yeah, definitely. And honestly, I think that was my biggest takeaway from the book, is the full title, Initium, Cognitive Science and Research-Informed Primary Practice, sounds scary, but oh my goodness, you have really made it understandable. And I love is how, again, although then it sounds very science-focused and research-focused, you don't lose sight of the joys, the realities, the playfulness that you mentioned, Emma, of working within the primary phase. Like, you have still captured that as well.
Yeah, and it is an absolute joy. And one of the things I say at the beginning of the book is that I hope that the joy of primary jumps off the page as much as the science, because I think that if we forget about the former, then the latter's not going to land as well. So we need to make sure that the absolute joy of working with our youngest children isn't lost along the way, as we try to kind of analyse our practice to make sure it's research informed.
Yeah, honestly, in my opinion, you definitely have not lost it. If anything, you've made it clearer why we mustn't lose sight of that. And that's what the book does really well. It talks about the cognitive science and the big concepts, but it also talks about that human element of teaching tiny people. Yes. So you really have. I think it has landed just right. The next question, a bit of a challenge.
Okay.
I know we've spoken about the book. Could you give us 3 key words that you would use to describe your book?
Right. I'm not going to give you 3 words that I said. I'm going to give you some words that somebody else said.
Okay.
So Sam Strickland said it is an incredible tour de force. Everett Wow. Blair said it empowers educators, and Mr. Sherrington said it is a triumph. So I'm not going to tell you three words for me to describe it. So Sam Strickland said incredible tour de force, effort first, it empowers educators, and Tom says it's a triumph. So I'm not going to blow my own trumpet. I'm going to let those three do it for me.
Oh, I love that. That's very humble of you. But, you know, three big names there with three very confident reviews. I love all of those three. I kind of like that second one about empowering and empowerment. Mm-hmm. And actually, yeah, that's, if I had to have said one of those three myself, that would be my one. I do think it's a triumph. I do think it's a tour de force. But actually, it does empower you as an educator. It empowers you to actually understand the research behind what you're doing. It's so important. So yeah, that middle, who was that middle quote?
That was from my absolute idol, Effret First. And I'm a complete fangirl of her work.
Oh, I love that.
When she wrote that, I was like, oh.
Wow, that's the cherry on top, right?
Yeah. I want to frame that one and put it on the wall somewhere in my office.
I think you are well within your rights to print and frame that. All of those to be printed and framed. It's wonderful.
Thank you.
I think it's, you know, when you write a book, you don't always know how it will be received, do you? But honestly, this book has clearly been met with, you know, it's very timely, and it's been met with very like welcome open arms, I think, Emma.
Thank you.
Especially, I think children in the young years often do get the rawer end of the stick, because we're often so focused on things like SATs at year six, aren't we? That sometimes it feels like everything's just leading towards the upper end of key stage two, in my opinion. What do you think?
Well, I was a diehard year six teacher for a very long time. Did 7 straight years in year six. So I was,
wow.
I totally understand the year six landscape, shall we say. But I never went into education to focus on a data sheet. I always went into education to work with our youngest learners and to be alongside them as they kind of take their first steps into formal education. So that will always be what kind of encourages me to write, encourages me in my work, is that, you know, what's the purpose of working with our youngest learners? What do we really want for them, and how do we make that happen in the most efficient and the best way and the most suitable, appropriate ways for them possible? So that's always my kind of modus operandi. What's best for the children, and how do we facilitate that in an age and stage appropriate way?
I love that, and I think that is clear in the pages. And for anyone listening, if you want to continue living Emma's vision and values, this is the book for you. This is the book you need for 2024 to really understand the science behind those people in our classrooms. Emma, we're so short on time. I've got just two more questions.
Okay,
please.
I'll be quick. Yep, I should do a
These are quickies. These are quick ones. If anyone wants to buy Initium, mm-hmm. Where is the best place for them to buy it or find it?
There is a very well-known online retailer that does Prime delivery. You can get it off there, or you can get it directly from John Catt, or I think you can get it from Smiths and Waterstones as well. So any quick Google of it and it will come up in multiple retailers.
Wonderful. John Catt, such a good publisher. I think as well, just when I saw that you'd publish with John Catt, I thought, I know that's going to be a good book.
Thank you.
Very excellent reputation. So yeah, congratulations on your contract, getting the book written, getting it published. And the last question then, for those of you who've listened today, thank you for coming and listening to Emma Turner. If they want to come and find you on socials or pick up the conversation around Initium or any of your other books, where's the best place people can come and find you online, Emma?
Well, it's Twitter or X or whatever we're calling it nowadays, and my handle is Emma_Turner75, and I rue the day I put that handle together because it gives away my age. So Emma_Turner75, you can find me on there, and you can also follow the work that Tom and I do. You can contact me via there as well.
That's brilliant. I've just dropped that handle for anyone listening live, at Emma_Turner75. And I know that John Catt have been sharing your book on their socials as well, as have I. So The main takeaway for today is if you haven't heard of Emma Turner, check her out because she has written a brilliant book around cognitive science and why we need research-informed primary practice called Initium or Initium.
Ask Bradley. That's all I'm going to say. You know, I think he's the only person in education who knows how to pronounce it.
But you know what? You know what, Emma? What's important about this book is not what's on the front cover, but all the amazing stuff that is inside.
Thank you.
So just thank you so much for writing it. Thank you everyone who's been listening today. Emma, have you got any final words for our listeners or just generally for Teachers Talk Radio before we finish?
No, just thank you very much for having me on. It's been an absolute delight to talk to you, and it's really great to see so many primary practitioners on my sort of timeline sharing all of their fantastic primary based practice. So thank you to colleagues there, and thanks once again for having me on.
Thank you so much, Emma. Lots of people in the chat, Emma's wishing you a good rest of the day, thanking you for your time to come up your very busy week to come and talk to us on Teachers Talk Radio about your brilliant book, Initium. Just a secret, Emma, tell us and the listeners, is there another book on the horizon?
Yeah. Yes, there is. There's a few, actually. There's one about assessment in the foundation subjects in primary school, which is part finished. There is also there's one coming out about primary culture and developing a positive primary culture across your school. And then I'm also editing the primary in action series for John Catt for the Tom Sherrington in action series. So I'm guest editing all of the series for those as well. So my name will be popping up on the JC book list a fair few times, hopefully over the next few months.
Hooray, hooray. I'm going to be keeping my eyes peeled because I love your work. I love your writing style. I will be adding these to my reading list as soon as they come out. And hopefully, Emma, we'll have you back on a future show to talk about your next books, if that's okay.
Thank you. That'd be lovely. Thanks, Poppy.
Thank you so much, Emma. And thank you everyone who's been listening today. That was our brilliant, very special guest, Emma Turner. Check her out at Emma_Turner75. Buy her book, Initium, if you want to become the best practitioner you can be. And I wish you all a wonderful weekend. It's lovely to have you here, as always. Enjoy the sunshine, enjoy some mindful breaks, and look after yourself.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.